I almost said your songbooks. In your Bibles to Psalm 139. Psalm 139. Growing up and getting different jobs, there's one thing that I really enjoy doing, and that's working by myself or helping others do a job and training them, seeing them being able to do it, and then leaving them to it, trusting them to get the job done and train them in such a way so that they are able to now do it themselves and possibly train others. That gave the opportunity. I've had that multiple times as I've been going there. But one of the most annoying things for me, and it's probably the same thing for many in here, is that if you are at a job and you have a boss, an employer, a manager, something like that, is where they are standing there looking at you over your shoulder, where they're watching every move you make, where you feel that they are there, they've got maybe bad breath or body odor or something, but they're standing there and they're just right next to you and they're like, okay, is he doing it right? Even after you've been trained, even after you know how to do the procedure, you understand how to do it, they're still there, just always watching you. Always feel like somebody's looking at you over your shoulder, making sure you don't mess up, or waiting for you to mess up. When we were working on the building out here, I found out a couple of different things about myself. One thing I knew beforehand is that I'm very comfortable, I'm pretty good at public speaking. I don't mind doing it, I enjoy it, it's fun for me. But one thing I found out when I was working on the building is that I'm not a carpenter or a plumber or a drywall guy or a construction person at all. I mean, I can do the job, I can get it done, and I can help somebody. I'm a great gopher, like go for this or go for that. I'm a great gopher, but I'm not a carpenter. There are many, many times while I'm there and Mr. DeHaven is there or others who know what they're doing and I'm helping put together a wall and for whatever reason they've already finished their side and I'm still working on my third nail or something like that. But they're watching me and especially with something I'm not good at, when somebody's watching me, it just makes it worse. Okay, if nobody's there, if I'm building a wall by myself, I can hit the nails pretty straight. They're not too bent by the time they get in there. There's not too many dents around the board where the head of the nail is at. I'm not too bad. But if somebody's watching me, I don't know why. It's not that I'm nervous. It's just that my quality of work degrades massively if somebody is watching me there. It's just how it is there. And so as we go through this passage here in this chapter, I want you to have the mindset of somebody looking at you over your shoulder as you go throughout every aspect of your life. Let's look at verse 1 of Psalm 139. This says here is the Psalm of David. It says, O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my down sitting and my uprising. Thou understandest my thoughts afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. And so those first four verses there, David here is saying, the Lord, you have searched me and you have known me. Now, if we're looking for something, we don't just do a casual glance over. If you're searching for something, you're moving stuff out of the way, you're trying to find something. I did this morning, actually. There's a pair of shoes I wanted to wear, and I couldn't find them. And see, when I was a bachelor, it was okay, because my shoes were wherever I left them. But after I got married, all of my stuff keeps moving. I mean, I didn't move it, and so I'm guessing my wife did it. But it's the kind of thing is like, I can't find my socks from yesterday. They're not in the living room where I left them. I can't find my plate from last night. It's not on the table like I left it. It's like all these things there. No, and I've gotten a lot better with it. But things of mine just mysteriously move now that there's somebody else living in the house with me. It's just, I'm blaming my wife because it probably is her fault, thankfully. But what it is there is, if I am looking for something, like this morning I was looking for my shoes, I was looking through the closet, I was looking under the bed, I was looking through the basket that's in the living room that's of shoes, because she finally just gave up moving them to the bedroom and just put a basket in there for me. It's so convenient. But it's always, I was looking for my shoes, and so that's the idea here in verse 1. It says that the Lord has searched me. It's not that the Lord has gone just kind of glanced over my life. He doesn't just glance over our lives, but he has gone and he looks at it. Like somebody who studies a book or studies a person or studies a subject, something in that mindset. That is what they've done. God has gone and he searches us. He looks at us thoroughly on purpose. There are other times when we are looking for something, you can't find it. And so you do the kind of thing where you stop looking for it and then 10, 15 minutes later you find it. That also is not what God does here. God is constantly looking at us, searching us, looking through us, like pages in a book, going to each page, looking at each one on purpose and deliberately is what he's doing there. But who is doing it? I keep saying the word Lord or God is doing that. If you have the King James translation, some of the other translations do this. The word Lord there is in all capitals, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. What that means there is that when the translators, when the writers, the original, in this case, David even was writing this, they wanted to make sure people knew who exactly they were talking about. Instead of just putting the word Lord there, they used God's name, Yahweh. And in this case, what they didn't, they saw God's name as something precious, something pure. So they didn't even put out his full name there. They would just use some of the letters that were in it. In the Hebrew, ancient Hebrew language, they did not have a lot of vowels. And so it was basically, it was YHWH there. And they'd have it in all caps. They'd do that way. Another word, another name for God that is synonymous to this, as you may know, is Adonai. And this is the personal name of God, the personal friendship there. And so if you're dealing with somebody in your life, when you meet somebody, there's multiple different ways that you can address them. This past week, I had a situation come up and somebody asked me for my name. I said, my name is Stuart Rogers, and they addressed me as Mr. Rogers. Well, many people here would address me as Pastor Rogers, Pastor Stuart, Mr. Rogers. Or if you know me well, you would just say Stuart. That is my personal name. That's my first name there. And that's the idea of Yahweh here, that God is looking at it and saying, my personal God is the one that is searching me, is the one that is looking at me there. And so he says, you have searched me and known me, focusing there on purpose. Look then down at verse 4. Here he's talking about, so he says that you know my, or look back at verse 2 real quick, sorry. He says, thou knowest my down sittings and my upright. You know when I'm sitting down, you know when I'm getting up, when I'm laying down, whatever it is. You understand my thoughts afar off, and that's not necessarily just the distance, like God is afar away from us, but the thoughts that still haven't come yet, God understands them. Thou compass me about, or thou surround me, you surround my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. You understand me completely. Verse 4, for there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Other translations there have the wording there is like, you know what I'm going to say before I'm going to say it. Growing up, having the personality that I did, being the person that I did, I was told many times by my parents, you need to think about what you say before you say it. I was told that so many times as a little kid. And as I got a little bit older, it got to the point where I did. I started to think about what I wanted to say before I said it, and then I said it anyway. And it's not that I was disrespectful or rude, but my dad, I would get home and I would have gotten in trouble because I was talking out of turn or something like that. My dad's like, you need to think about what you say before you say it. And I learned never to, you know, come back at it with something like this. But in my mind, I was thinking, but I did think about it. And it was okay at the time. Of course, granted, the teacher didn't think it was okay, so it didn't work out there. But you need to think about what you say before you say it. Or for me personally, I do something that a lot of people look at it and say, why in the world do you do that? But if I'm bored or something, I will sit down and I will have, it's kind of embarrassing to say, I will have imaginary conversations with myself. Okay? Both sides of the conversation. I will have the conversation. Well, why would you do that? Well, honestly, I kind of view it as like practicing. Just in case a situation comes up, this is how I would handle it. And I do that. Like, I'll think of scenarios and situations, and I'll sit through the conversation, think out both sides, and more times than actually I thought would ever happen, situations come up where I can use that conversation that I practiced with myself earlier on. And I'm like, hey, this is great. I already went through this like 2 weeks ago in my head. I don't tell the person that because, like I said, it's kind of embarrassing, a little weird. I don't know how many other people do that. But it's even there where somebody says, you need to think about what you say before you say it. And a lot of us do. As you get older, you get the ability and the responsibility to do that. But that's not what David is saying here about God. He's not saying that he hears the words as I'm thinking them before I say them. He's saying before the thought, before the words, before the ideas even come to my mind, God, you know them. Now remember how I mentioned at the beginning, the picture of somebody staring at us over our shoulder. Keep that in your mind here. We're actually going to skip over verses 5 and 6. And go to verse 7. We'll come back to those two verses. But verse 7 says, whither shall I go from thy spirit? Whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up to the heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light against about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee. And we'll stop there. But these verses here, again, the idea of somebody staring at us over the shoulder. In our Christian lives, God is always there with us. It says here, it goes through different things, and we'll talk about them in a moment here, but that God is always there watching us. In verse 7, 8, and 9, it talks about different opposites. It gives us two sets of opposites. It says, if I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I go to hell, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning or go to the uttermost parts of the sea, you are there. Now, two sets of opposites, total different directions there. Heaven, we are very easily understanding what that is, the place that you go when you're saved, the communion there with God. We know where that is, the place where God dwells. But then it gives the word here, at least in the King James, it says the word hell. But that is not talking about the place, the realm of Satan. A lot of people mistake hell as that's where Satan rules. That's where he's at. That when you come there, when you go to heaven, you're at the pearly gates and St. Peter checks you through. When you're at hell, Satan is there at the gates and he checks you through. That's not what hell is. Hell is a place of eternal suffering that Satan will be cast into with his fallen angels, with the unbelievers. But that's not necessarily talking about here. It's not saying that if David were to go to hell, that's where God would, that God is in hell. It's not talking about that. The word is actually the word Sheol, and some of the more modern translations, it uses that. The word Sheol has the idea of the place of death, or the just being dead. So David is saying, whether I die and go to heaven, or I die and I'm buried in the earth, you are there. You see me. There's nothing I can do that will get me away from your presence. And then it says here, if I take the wings of the morning, or if I go to the sunrise, where does the sun rise? What direction? It rises in the east, which in this case, if you were in Israel, like David would have been, east is towards modern-day Iraq, China, that area there. And then it's talking about the uttermost parts of the sea. Well, that's the Mediterranean Sea. That's to the west. As far out into the what they would have seen as the ocean, the Mediterranean Sea, as far out as you could possibly go, no matter which direction it is, you're not going to get away from God. Jonah would have had a much better time if he had taken this passage to heart, that you cannot hide from God by going out to the sea there, that you can't do that. So no matter where you go, God is there. And then verse 12 says, if the darkness hideth not from me. I can't make it dark, as even in the darkness, that darkness is as light to your eyes. So those things there, if you have in your mind right now, oh my goodness, God is watching over me. God is like a boss, a manager, ready to sit there watching over me, paying attention to see what I'm going to do. So when I mess up, he's ready there to do it. But he's not. Look back at verses 5 and 6 that we skipped over earlier. Let's go ahead to verse 4 just to pick up from there. It says, for there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. And then here we go, is this passage here that says, thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid thy hand upon me. Verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful to me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Now verse 5, it talks about, thou hast beset me behind and before. That is the idea of God has gone forth and put a guard in front of me, behind me, and laid thy hand upon me. God has put his hand of protection upon me. And then verse 6, reading it in the King James, it's not real clear there, but it's saying here, the too wonderful, it's not the idea that it's unattainable, it's so great that I can't have it. He does mention it there at the end. But what he's saying there is such knowledge is so wonderful. I am thrilled. I am excited. I am overjoyed. It is wonderful, God, that you are always there with me, that you sit beside me. So with that in your mind, with that idea that God is there watching us, that he's there caring for us, let's read again through verse 7, but with a little bit different of a mindset. Instead of an overbearing boss or manager looking down upon us, let's look at it as the omniscient, all-powerful, all-caring God looking at us. Verse 7, whither shall I go from thy spirit? Whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee. And so David is looking at it here saying, God, you know my thoughts. You know me from afar. You know whether it's dark, whether it's light, whatever the situation is, God, you know what's going on, and that is incredible for me to know about. And in our Christian lives, that's what it should be. That it should be something that is incredible, that is phenomenal for us to realize God is always with us. I've been doing a lot of study recently on different worldviews that are not the biblical worldview or just different ideas and things like that. And worldview is something that's been pushed to the forefront of a lot of people's minds because of the Bill Nye and the Ken Ham debates, the Noah Ark Project in Kentucky from the Creation Museum there. All these things have been pushed to the forefront of worldviews. And it's fascinating to me as I go through and study the different ways societies, civilizations, and today people think. And I look at that, and majority of them, it is hopeless for them. They have the idea, secular mindset, the people that have thought about this, that when I die, that's it. I'm gone. I am a giant cosmic mistake that just happened to evolve into this intelligent being. It just happened to happen. And so if bad things happen to me, that's also just the cosmos leading its way. It's the way things happen. It is a hopelessness there that this is all they have. And then you look at people's lives and say, if this is all you have, why are you wasting it doing what you're doing? And then looking at it there, that all these things, they have no hope. They have no wonderful excitement of what God is able to do for them, of God being there to come along beside them, help them, protect them, and to guide them. But as Christians, we have that. And we have it where God looks at us and says, I am with you always, even until the ends of the earth. I will never leave you nor forsake you. There is nobody in our lives, a human being, that can say that I will never leave you nor forsake you. One of the most close relationships that you will have is a marriage relationship. But even then, and what I've learned over the past several months is in that relationship, you will have times where you are upset about that person. You want to leave their presence. You want to get away from them. You can't stand them at that time. But God looks at us and says, I will never not stand you. If you are my son, I will always be there. If you are my child, I will always be there with you. I am not going to drift from you. The several passages talk about God being a solid rock or a mighty fortress or a strong tower. What's really crazy about those things is, generally speaking, they don't move. A tower does not move. A strong fortress, the only way for that to be moved is if it is destroyed. It's the only way to take place there. In recent history, past 50 years or so, if somebody sees a house, and they want to move that house to another location, we actually have the technology today to do that. But for so many thousands of years, if you wanted to move something, you had to destroy it and then rebuild it elsewhere. God is not able to be destroyed. God is not able to be moved. Like I said, He does not move. And so God's saying, I am right here. If we ever find ourselves away from God, it's not because God started drifting off when we weren't paying attention. It's because we drifted away from God when we weren't paying attention, is what it is there. And God is always there, though, that we're able to do that. Look at verse 13 here. We see David goes in even more detail about what God knows, what God has done for us. It says, for thou hast possessed my reins, and thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did not see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which is in continuance were fashioned when as yet they were none. How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God! How great is the sum of them! Looking there, the word is kind of confusing in the several verses there, but it's the idea, verse 13, where God knows us. He says, I knew you in the womb. I knew you before the womb. He says even, it says, verse 15, my substance was not hid from thee. In other words, my bones, the skeletons, all of that, what makes me up, God knew it was there. The word there in the King James, the curiously, is the idea of skillfully. God carefully designed each and every one of us. And for me, that is something that is a phenomenal to think about. Throughout every single one of our lives, we have had times, will have times, where we look at some attribute, some physical part of us, where we say, I wish I could change this. I wish God had done something differently. For me, for the longest time, it was actually my red hair. Growing up as a redhead, you get picked on a lot about it. And even this week, as some of the campers who, but they made fun of me about my hair. And I looked at them and I said, we're at camp. Well, I said it in my head, actually. I thought about what I was going to say before I said it. I said, we're at camp, so I can't push you on the ground and kick you. And I didn't say anything. I just kind of looked at him as he was making fun of me. But I was like, you know, it's one of those kind of things where God has made us, God's created us, given me the red hair. And honestly, I have used that in the past as an opportunity to talk to people with my red hair. One joke that I have with people is that when I see another redhead or whatever, we start talking about something, and I was like, we redheads got to stick together. And then you say that, and actually the first person that said it to me was Joe Crane when I was in junior high. And it's the idea there, it instantly creates a bond there where the two people realize we're both redheads, we've both been made fun of so many times because of our hair. And it's one of those kind of things that we're able to use that to talk to each other. It opens up opportunities for me. And every single thing that God has done for us, he says here that David says, God, you have skillfully made me. You have done this for me. I don't know, maybe right now in your life, I don't know why God did this for me or why God did it this way for me. We don't know the situations there. I had a friend when I worked at the Wilds one summer, and he had a mild case of cerebral palsy. And you could tell by the way that he walked, kind of limped a little bit. And during our weekly meetings, he gave a testimony and was praising God because of the cerebral palsy that he had. What he was saying, that he stood up and he said, I'm sure a lot of you guys know, but I have cerebral palsy. That's why I walk the way I do. God gave me the opportunity this week to talk to somebody else who had cerebral palsy. The opportunity that he had, he was able to go there, instantly connect with this camper that was there, and talk to them, encourage him in the Lord, and to show that God can use different things in our lives. And that was something there, that everything that's in our lives, every situation that comes up, God is able to use. Now there, look at verse 16. It says, thy eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect. And the idea, the thinking there, the substance refers to the unborn child, is what it's talking about there. It's not fully grown. It's not perfected there. Not necessarily talking about holiness. It says, yet being unperfect. And in thy book, all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as they were yet, was none of them. Here David is saying, God, you knew each one of my members, each one of my parts, each thing that's going to put together to make me before I was even put together. It's the look there where God lays us out and says, I know this is going to be you. So what are we doing with that knowledge? Knowing that God is with us, knowing that God has formed us, that God has put us together in that way. One thing that we should be doing is the exact thing that David does here, verse 17 and 18. How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God. How great is the sum of them. How great, when I look at every single time that you have thought about me and I add all of those things together, it is phenomenal for me to think about that you are thinking about me in that way. We go throughout our day and we see people. We see I see every single person that's in this room here today. But I don't see you. I see your body. I can see how you interact. But the best way I've heard it described as humanity is each person, as you're going through, is each person is an anthill. In your life, you have your thoughts, your cares, your desires that are all inside of you. But on the surface, only thing anybody ever sees is that little mound of you, of who you are. But every single person has those branching thoughts that go underneath them. And when you go to a store, when you go to a city, and you see each person, you see every single one of them has a care, has concerns, has issues, has problems, has loved ones, all branching out underneath the surface there. And every single one of those things, God knows about, God cares about. And when we look at that and say every single one of the things that I've ever thought about, that I ever will think about, that will ever be a concern to me, God has thought about that already, and that is just unfathomable how much God cares for me. Because he looks at it there and he thinks about that. When you're dealing with people, sometimes people will constantly come to you with their problems, with their situations. Or they're just the kind of person that they just always want to talk to you. They always want to be with you and talk to you. And sometimes you look at them and say, not right now, I just need some me time. Thank God that God never says to me, not right now, Stuart Rogers, I just need some me time. He doesn't do that to any of us. Why? Because he loves us. Verse 18, here we go again. David is looking at it and saying, if I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with thee. If there is any possible way I could count how many thoughts God has about me, the sand would not be enough to number those thoughts. And then he adds just a little part there on the end. When I awake, I am still with thee. And think about that. When I wake up, God didn't drift off in the night, get distracted by something else. The Old Testament, one of my most favorite stories is where Elijah fought the prophets of Baal on the Mount Carmel, and where Elijah kind of gets there and has a little comical interlude there. He says, well, maybe Baal is on vacation, or maybe Baal is sleeping. Maybe he just doesn't care right now. That will never happen. God does not take a vacation. God does not need to get away from humanity because we're too much for him. But he does look at us and he says, I am with you always, even to the ends of the earth. Turn back to the beginning of the chapter in verse 1. And I want us to read through these 18 verses here again. But with the mindset, not that God is an overpowering, overbearing ogre of a manager ready to pounce on us, waiting for us to make mistakes so he can fire us and get rid of us. But that he is a loving God that is there with us at all times. That is there not because he necessarily needs to be, but because we need him to be and because he wants to be. Verse 1, O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou hast known my down-sitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid thy hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall my hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee. For thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that thy my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee, when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuous were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them. How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God! How great is the sum of them! If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with thee. God here is always with us, all the time, every time. There's two more points I'd like to make here. Look at verse 10. It says, even there shall thy hand lead me, thy right hand shall hold me. Even today, people use the expression, he is my right-hand man. In the Civil War, when Stonewall Jackson was first shot, his left arm had to be amputated. And it says, Robert E. Lee, when he heard about that, he said, Jackson has lost his left arm, but I have lost my right. The right hand has always been seen as a body part of purpose, of power, of strength. It says that Jesus sits at the right hand of God. And so here, it's not just saying in the first part, it could have said easily in the beginning of verse 10, even there shall thy hand lead me and thy hand shall hold me. It would have been perfectly understandable for us that God would have seen and taken perfect care of us with His hand. But it's not just His hand. It is His hand of power. It is His hand of guidance. It is the hand that people look at and realize that is the important one. With the idea of writing, that many people have a dominant right hand. And that's what God is using to help us, is His hand that is dominant, the one that is, if you will, more important. That is what God is leading us with. That David makes specific reference to that God is going and directing His children with His almighty right hand. The one that for a king would hold the scepter. The one that for many people when they go out to shake a hand, it's that hand. Why? Because that one is viewed as the important one. God looks at us and sees each individual human as so important that He would use His dominant hand, His royal hand, to direct us and to lead us. The final point I want to make, I've been speaking this whole sermon today to Christians. Everything there that if you are a child of God, if you can look at God and say, Yahweh, you know my thoughts. Personal God, you know my thoughts. But in a group this size, it would be foolish of me to think that every single person listening is a Christian, is a child of God. Where in your mind you may read this passage and go through these words and be like, well, God, it is an ogre. He does look over me like that. That He is ready for me to mess up and for Him to just pounce on me. That's not the God we serve. That's not the God you can serve. That you can go to and say, Lord, save me. Recognizing that I am a sinner. That Your Son came and died on the cross for me. That He did that for us. Yes, we are God's children that are saved. But God sent His only begotten Son. That whosoever shall believe. He sent His own Son for us so that He would die and so that we would not have to perish. We would have the eternal life. That's what God did. And if you're in the situation now where you look at it and say, one, I don't know if I'm saved. I don't know if I'm a child of God. Or you look at it and you say, I'm not. Well, now is the appointed time. Now is the day of salvation, the Bible says. We don't know what is coming up in our lives, but God does. Whatever the situation is, whatever happens there. I was talking to a sponsor this past week about different things that happen in our lives and how situations can arise. About 2 weeks ago, a friend of mine was in a car accident. 9 years ago, I went to Australia with this guy. His name was Ryan. We spent 9 weeks there ministering to the locals there, having camps, Bible schools, all these different things, and had a great time getting to know him. Haven't talked to him for many, many years. I've kept in contact with people on the team, but not this last Thursday, but Thursday before, we get a message from one of the team members that says that Ryan was in a car accident, and he's with the Lord. What had taken place, he was driving down the highway in Indiana. For whatever reason, the traffic had slowed down. He went up underneath a tractor trailer. When they got him to the hospital, he was brain dead. And when you think about that, when you see that, when you hear that, the guy was 27 years old. In a few weeks, he was in the Marines. In a few weeks, he was about to be on his first deployment. But when you see and hear that, everybody that was on that news, on that message board that we were communicating back and forth, all of us from the team, we were mentioning about the memories that we've had of him, the good times that we had, and how sad and really heartbroken we were for him and his family. But there was also a joy there because we knew he was in heaven. We knew that even though he had died in that car accident, he left this body on earth and is now in a perfect body with our holy Savior and God up in heaven. That is an assurance that we as believers have. And if you are not a believer, you do not have that assurance. You do not have that calm, that peace that passes all understanding. It is not humanly understandable why we should be okay when a fellow believer dies. Why should we be that? Because God knows us all the time and every time. That God looks at us and He fearfully and wonderfully made us. And that's something that we need to be constantly reminding ourselves about, believers. And unbelievers, if you are sitting there and you say, I don't have that peace. I don't have that idea that I'm fearfully made. Seek someone out. Search someone. Find someone. And ask them. And anybody here, the deacons, the adults, the men, the women, they would be would love to help lead you to the Lord there. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you so much that we are fearfully and wonderfully made, that you have known us since before we were born, that you know our thoughts from afar off, that you hedge us in from behind and before, that you are there and you are seeing and that you know us every day, all day. Lord, I ask that you would be with those that have heard this message here today, that you would help us to remember these things, to come to you gladly, to look at you as the caring and loving Father that you are. With your heads bowed and your eyes closed, I'm going to have the piano play through just two stanzas of a song and give you the opportunity to sit there and, Christians, to look at God and say, God, thank you. Or unbelievers, non-Christians, to say, God, save me, help me. Todd and Sherry Chandler are going to be in the back. And believers or unbelievers, if you would like to talk to someone, feel free to slip out now and do that.